Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
On Open House, we're in week three of an absorbing series of conversations with the New York Times bestselling author Eric Metaxas on the seven men he's written about in his new book, Seven Men and Their Secret of Greatness, from George Washington to Chuck Colson. Last week, we explored the lives of William Wilberforce and Eric Liddell, well worth catching on the podcast page of our Open House community website. Tonight, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and a man that not many Australians will probably know, Jackie Robinson. I must say in passing that our conversation last year with Eric about his full biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer features in our next Open House book. Eric Metaxas, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've loved this series. Before we look at these two men in particular, Eric, I want to ask you about one statement you make about all the seven men. And that's this: faith is at the heart of what these men did and why they did it, and it often carried them through great adversity. How did that happen then?
Well, I think that it's important to say, again, living in a pretty secular culture, I live in New York City, and I assume Australia's similar, where you often hear negative stories about faith, about fanatics, crazy people. We need to know that some of the key figures in history did great things, very great things, specifically because of their faith. And that's the case with Jackie Robinson. Most people have no idea in the U.S. that he was a Christian. We'll tell that story in a minute. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer stood up to Hitler, spoke up for the Jews of Europe because of his Christian faith. What an extraordinary story. I remember when I first heard it in the summer of 1988, I was flabbergasted. My mother's German, so it meant a lot to me, and I was just touched that this man lived his faith, did the right thing at a time when almost no one did the right thing, and I was intrigued, and I said, why don't people know this story? This is inspiring. This puts faith in a beautiful light, a man who really lived it and did the right thing, and I just thought, we need to know these stories. These are true stories, and they must be told.
Yes. So Bonhoeffer came from both a brilliant and a very devout family, which shaped him similarly.
Yes, what an amazing family. In my 600-page book on Bonhoeffer, I go into the family in depth. In this book, Seven Men, of course, I don't go so deeply into it, but I do say that they were a spectacular family, very academically ambitious. They were all geniuses. They all were, studied hard, and you know, his brother split the atom with Einstein and Max Planck. They were just amazing human beings. The father was the most famous psychiatrist in Germany for the first half of the 20th century, so famous brain doctor, scientist. And so this is the culture of the family. They were trained to think clearly, to express themselves clearly, to really follow arguments with a rigorous logic, almost to be a scientist in approaching life. Well, what's the evidence, and where does it lead us? And this, of course, stood Bonhoeffer in good stead later on when Hitler rose to power, and Bonhoeffer had to think through very logically, what does this mean for me as a Christian? What do I do? What is the right thing to do? So it's beautiful.
Eric, in Bonhoeffer's mid-20s, he went to study in the United States. Tell us why, in just 9 months there, he was so profoundly impacted in the U.S.
Yeah, he was 24 years old, and he wanted to be a Lutheran minister. He couldn't get ordained in Germany until you're about 25, and so he decided to spend a year in America. He's already gotten his Ph.D. in theology. He's a brilliant theologian. But he comes to America, to New York City, about 2 miles from where I am right now. He comes to Union Theological Seminary to study there. Now, he wasn't expecting to find much by way of theology. He'd studied at the greatest university for theology in the world, Berlin University. But he comes here, and what he experiences in New York had much less to do with his academics. He didn't actually think much of the academics at Union at the time. But he went up one Sunday to an African-American church in Harlem. An African-American student, a friend of Bonhoeffer's, invites him to go up to Harlem. He visits Abyssinian Baptist Church. What he experiences that morning, I would say, simply changes his life. He was a quite serious Christian before that, but somehow God got a hold of his heart. He saw a congregation of people who knew suffering, a huge congregation. I think it was maybe the largest in the world at the time, a gigantic church. And he sees them worshiping God, singing with passion, worshiping a real God, not just going through the motions as many people did at church, but really living their faith. The preaching was fiery preaching, evangelistic preaching, preaching that compelled people to live out their faith on the streets, to help the poor, to do all these things. He was really moved, and he went to that church just about every Sunday that he was in New York. Remarkable thing for a blonde German to go up to this African-American church, but he did it, and when he got back to Germany, people could see that he was somehow changed. God had gotten a hold of his heart in a way that was noticeable.
And back in Germany, the Nazis presented the established Christian church there with a great challenge that Bonhoeffer did see with great clarity.
It's extraordinary. He comes back to Germany. The Nazis are rising in power. And Bonhoeffer seems to be practically alone in understanding what this means for Germany. And he begins to speak out against the Nazis and to speak out against what they are doing to the Jews. Already in the early 30s, they were making laws, making it very difficult for Jews to hold positions and to do anything. And then finally, the Nazis said that Jews cannot be a part of the German church. Now imagine, so many Jews, ethnic Jews, had converted to Christianity, were going to churches in Germany for, you know, decades, if not generations. And the Nazis said, no, we want a racially pure German church, and so the Jews have to get out. And Bonhoeffer at this point says, wait a minute, the church is not defined by ethnicity, it's not defined by race, it's defined by your faith in Jesus Christ. And we have no right to do this. This is absolutely wrong. This is Nazi ideology being imported into the church, and it's not biblical. And so he stood against it bravely. Finally, Bonhoeffer and a number of pastors signed something called the Barman Declaration, and they separated from the Nazified heretical state church of Germany at the time and formed what's called a confessing church. And in many ways, you know, those are the good guys in the story.
So with ever diminishing opportunities to serve God in Germany, yeah, Bonhoeffer again went to the United States, but only for 26 days.
This is so amazing. So through the 30s, He's doing so many things. I mean, he goes to London for 18 months, and he's an assistant vicar in a German-speaking congregation. Then he comes back to Germany, and he leads an illegal seminary for the confessing church, because, of course, the German Nazi church was not raising up men of God. And then in the late 30s, he realizes that the Nazis are gaining more and more power, and his ability to serve God is diminishing. He can't speak publicly. He can no longer publish. He wrote a book on the Old Testament Psalms. The Nazis didn't like the Old Testament. They thought it was too Jewish. I mean, it's just on and on, insanity. And then the war is coming, and Bonhoeffer knows he cannot fight in Hitler's war, so he goes back to New York, back to America, ostensibly to escape what is coming and then to return when it's all over. Well, no sooner does he get off the boat in June of 1939, then he knows he's missed God. He's praying and praying. He's looking at the scriptures every day, asking God to speak to him. And he really comes to believe that he's made a mistake and he must go back. Now, we have to understand, people had pulled strings for him to get out of the country and to be in New York. And he just wipes all that away and says, I've made a mistake. And he goes back to Germany to do what? Well, mainly to do something that he couldn't announce publicly. He joins German military intelligence. That's what people knew publicly. But what he was actually doing was he was now officially joining the plot against Adolf Hitler. That was centered in German military intelligence. His brother-in-law was a leading figure in German military intelligence, and he felt God led him to be involved in the conspiracy against the head of his own government. A very dramatic move theologically. Yes. Most people wouldn't have understood it, but he felt God had led him to do this.
He was eventually arrested and, of course, executed just before the end of World War II. Can I ask the same question as I did about Eric Liddell last week, the famous Olympic runner who died in a Chinese internment camp? People could be forgiven for thinking, what a waste.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's the same with Jesus. I mean, he dies at 33. He's about the most promising individual who's ever lived to walk the surface of the planet.
Yeah.
But God's ways are not our ways, and I think we really have to acknowledge that God is in charge, and we want him to be in charge. You know, if he wants me to live X number of years, I don't want to live another week. I want to go to be with him. I figure he's got the big picture. Bonhoeffer really knew the Lord personally. He prayed every day devoutly, and he had that relationship where God was leading him in all that he did. So when he went to the gallows, he knew that God had led him to this place and that it was okay. He had the peace of God. He really wanted to glorify God, and in everything he did, he had the peace of God, and I think that it's a remarkable example to us, again, you know, for, especially for young men, to look at a life and to see the peace, the joy, the purpose. This is what we're all supposed to have, and the story of Bonhoeffer, more than any of them, I think, it just inspires us to live that kind of a life. It really is hard not to be inspired by this great man.
Absolutely. So that's Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Next to the man of greatness, Jackie Robinson. My guess is few Australians have heard of him. I loved reading his story. Paint us a picture of Jackie Robinson, who, like Eric Liddell, was another greatly gifted sportsman.
Oh, incredible, yeah. Well, it is an amazing story. Basically, baseball, which has always been, not always, but mostly for the last century or so, been the national pastime of the United States, was, until the late 1940s, was segregated. There were no African Americans allowed to play in Major League Baseball. There was a separate Negro league, and in the 40s, a man named Branch Rickey, he was a very serious Methodist Christian, he decides that, you know, the right thing to do for God is to integrate baseball. He had to do it stealthily. He had to think, how can I do this? This would be the right thing. It would be the right thing financially, but he felt morally it would be the right thing. I should point out he was the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he was a really colorful figure and a very, very famous and influential figure in baseball. And he makes this decision to integrate baseball, to secretly bring an African-American athlete onto the minor league team, and then finally to promote him. So who will he pick? This is the question. There are a number of players and athletes in the Negro Leagues who are fantastic. Who will he pick? Well, he settles on this young man named Jackie Robinson, because Jackie Robinson's character, this is so important for people to realize, his character was noble. And Branch Rickey knew that if I cannot find someone with a noble character, a Christian, this experiment can fail. One false move, and we will lose everything that we fought for, and the whole thing will be set back 10 years. And so he settles on Jackie Robinson, and this is the key. In their meeting, in their initial meeting, Branch Rickey opens up a book called The Life of Christ, and he shares the passage where Jesus is speaking the Sermon on the Mount, the whole idea of turning the other cheek. And he says to Jackie Robinson, you're going to be attacked. There's a lot of racists. There are a lot of people that are just going to hate you. They're going to say horrible things. And he sort of acts it out. And he says, I'm asking you to do what your Lord and my Lord commands, to turn the other cheek. Now, this is an amazing moment in American civil rights history, and most people don't know Jesus is at the center of that, and that Branch Rickey, as a Christian, picking another Christian, asking him to do what Jesus commands us to do, it's incredible. And if Jackie Robinson had not agreed, I don't think it's possible that we would have integrated baseball for a long time. It was really tough when it happened, and it's important to say that Jackie Robinson sacrificed the right to fight back. You talk about a noble sacrifice. Every one of the men in Seven Men, in my book Seven Men, makes a sacrifice. This is it for Jackie Robinson. He gives up the right, every man would say, to fight back, and prays every night. It's an incredible tale.
Especially when you learn, as you reveal, that in his younger days, Jackie Robinson had a couple of brushes with the law over racism when he did hit back.
Oh, yeah. He was a very passionate person and very angry. And when he was young, he really would not take to being treated poorly. He would stand up for himself. And, of course, we all should stand up for ourselves. But he really was a bit hot-headed, got in trouble a few times. But the amazing thing is he met a pastor. This is, of course, before our story where he integrates baseball. But when he's a younger man, he meets a pastor named Carl Downs, an African-American pastor, who was very serious about his faith and who taught the young Jackie Robinson that it's harder not to fight back. If you want to do the noble, really manly thing, be above hitting back at certain key moments. You will be far greater. You will be the greater man. And this is the heroic thing. And what Jesus did in turning the cheek is a heroic, defiant thing, to stand up to evil that way, to repay evil with good. It's an amazing thing. And so he teaches Robinson this, and Robinson carries it into history.
And there was lots of abuse, both on the field and his life, in the coming 10 years with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, there was a film out recently here in the States. I don't know if it probably won't play down there, but it's called 42, and that's the number he wore, and it shows some of these things. And it's very hard to watch because this kind of rank naked racism, it's so ugly. It's so ugly. But, of course, the movie doesn't really go into his faith much. The way Robinson dealt with this abuse was through prayer. He would pray on his knees. He made a point of saying that praying on one's knees was important. He would pray on his knees at night, and God gave him the strength to fight this. It really is a story of history, but most Americans don't know that God and Jesus were at the very center of this story. They need to know that Jackie Robinson not only was a Christian, but lived his faith heroically, and never would have been able to do what he did if God hadn't been a part of it. So that's something I really delight in, being able to make that public. Civil rights was birthed out of the Christian faith, not just in the case of Jackie Robinson, but all through the civil rights movement, it was the Christian faith.
And he went on to play 151 games in the end without a single incident of retaliation, despite it all.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. He had, of course, a spectacular career. He was a tremendous athlete, but as tremendous as he was, I think this was my point last week, is that there are many people who do great things, there are many great athletes, but look at the ones like Jackie Robinson who do something far greater than put up great numbers, great statistics. He lived sacrificially. He gave up the right to fight back for other generations. He wanted to bless, you know, the young men who were coming up in baseball. And we remember him for that, not for the fact that he hit 330 or that he stole bases. I mean, that's part of the legend, but why do we remember him for this noble feat? And same thing with Eric Little. These athletes did something that goes way beyond athletic prowess. It's about character. And as I say, young men need to know these stories. Their history, they're true. These are manly men who did the right thing.
Eric Metaxas' book is Seven Men and the Secret of Their Greatness. Eric, I'm so grateful for this series. Next week, our final conversation, the former Pope, Pope John Paul II, and the former presidential staffer, prisoner, and prison ministry founder, Charles Colson. Eric, thanks so much again.
My pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.